following KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland 5, presenting an evening with an all-female mariachi band, Flor de Touloche, performing Thursday, February 23rd at the Newmark Theater. The band members hail from diverse cultural backgrounds which lend their own flavor and take on traditional Mexican music. Tickets and information for Mariachi Flor de Touloche are available at portland5.com. It's 5:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2016 Portland Veg Fest, Saturday and Sunday, October 22nd and 23rd at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Portland Veg Fest celebrates plant-based living with food samples, experts, and authors to discuss topics in health, animal welfare, and compassion, chef demonstrations, and more. Again, that's the 2016 Portland Veg Fest, Saturday and Sunday, October 22nd and 23rd at the Oregon Convention Center, Exhibit Hall A, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Crybaby, produced and performed by Stageworks, Inc. Crybaby will take place at the Clinton Street Theater Friday and Saturday, October 14th and 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, October 16th at 2 p.m. Crybaby Live is a rockabilly musical homage to the John Waters cult classic film set in the 1950s in Baltimore. Again, that's Crybaby, the play at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Stay tuned for Bread and Roses.
Tell me when to treat this like a real interview. Now?
Yeah, treat it like a...
This is very hard work to actually figure out how do you shift the world. I mean, I went to Uganda for 3 weeks thinking I am going to do the work of shifting the world. And I left going, oh God, I don't know. I do feel like my contributions towards shifting the world, while I did not save, this is the thing, is nobody needs to be saved. We are constantly, America needs to save ourselves.
As we come marching at the dawn of the day, darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on the KBOO airwaves since 1978, the longest-running feminist radio broadcast program in the country. Bread and Roses is a collective of women and non-binary radio activists who give voice to those in global and local spaces, working for social justice and equity. And we strive to challenge systems of oppression. All this and we have fun. We want our bread and roses too. Get it? I'm your host tonight, Pamela Santos. Tonight, I'm going to be bringing you an interview that I did with Christina Wong from the Wong Street Journal, which is premiering here in Portland October 13th, playing through the 23rd for 7 shows only. Boom Arts is presenting this Portland debut of pretty much what most anyone who can meet her or actually hear her art form has called a one-of-a-kind performer, provocateur, and all-around funny lady. Here's a little sneak peek.
The Wong Street Journal!
Money, 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 must be funny.
I'm Asian. Surprise! And to my parents' grave disappointment, I am not a Wall Street trader nor captain of industry. I am a performance artist who fights for the marginalized. And here is where I do my best work. The armchair. And this is what I use to take them all down. The iPad.
Christina, you cannot have an existential crisis right now. Existential crises are for those women who read, eat, pray, love. I'll go to hashtag Africa. The Dark Continent. Brought to you by white people. You know, here we call you Mzungu. That is Swahili for white person.
White privilege.
I rock the first iPhone. It's like a spaceship here, but a joke back at home. It's like I'm the Asian Oprah. Through African eyes, I'm the big white Oprah.
So as someone who is not black, not white, but is an Asian American performance artist, how do I engage this situation, leave a legacy, but without being a colonial asshole?
Like Dustin Hoffman and Tootsie, you gotta earn her consent if you wanna go near her. Every woman's Wonder Woman, superheroes without capes. I wish she had the power to stop gender violence and rape.
I have ruined Uganda! Woo!
Boss lady.
I'm here with Christina Wong, who is going to be talking about her show premiering here in Portland at Boom Arts, The Wong Street Journal.
Hey, Pamela. Wong Street Journal is happening at Headwaters Theater, October 13th through 23rd. The seven shows. You can go to boomarts.org. And now we're going to sell you on the show. Here we go.
It just seems like there's either a lot of women in certain parts of theater or not a lot of women in other parts. So in certain decision-making, I feel like you have this because you're putting your own work together.
Yeah. Well, I will say someone, I was just in Ashland, Oregon at the National Asian American Theater Festival at Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
Now,
and
just wanted to let you know a little bit about
Arab American scholar
other productions
like,
that Boom
was, like,
Arts
the hugest
is going to be
she's like, I think
putting
what
up
you
for
do.
Their
but
season.
Genre,
so
not just
me after the Wong Street Journal,
point, which is like, I think
it's actually
what you
backed
do in
by popular demand, Adrian
feminist,
Truscott's
most
asking for it. December 8th
most
to the
binary,
10th.
Like,
and
exploding
Adrian Truscott's
genre that there
a one-trick pony.
I agree.
On Saturday,
like when
December
I watch
10th,
what theater is doing
Sunday,
now,
December
people are so
11th.
Wowed by theater. I feel like theater
it's
is
also
chasing
the
tail
at the
of
headwaters,
what performance artists
where the
and solo
Street
performers
Journal
have
is.
Been doing forever, which is being incredibly personal, really like putting their bodies on the line. Performance that sort of blur, like, is this a ritual? Because it's the kind of performance that can't necessarily be performed over and over again, because it's so true to that person's life. Though I have seen solo performers tour the same show for 20 years, and that we don't need to wait for permission from big institutions, just small institutions maybe, to present work.
I think it's hard, and I know that you don't have to, but you can't speak for all women in theater, obviously.
I would not want to do that. I don't agree with all women in theater, like every single thing a woman has done in theater, and there's it's a lot of... It's a lot. I'll tell you what I think of me.
It's not waiting for permission, you said, from institutions. For someone who is putting art together, putting art that's going to be consumed by the public, how do you balance that then?
There's still permissions, right? That I'm just thinking, having come after watching, like, a theater like Oregon Shakespeare Festival, those actors have 8-month contracts. I think they're doing the show sometimes up to 6 months, if I get this right, in a row. And there's a very, at the Asian American Theater Festival at OSF, it was very easy to look in the audience and figure out who was at the conference and who was not. And it's a very older white demographic that is the consistent audience base. It's not a bad thing, an awful thing, but I know a lot of theaters across America are wondering. The ones that have reliant subscription bases are wondering what's going to happen in 20 years when, I hate to break this to you, demographic that subscribes to theater, you're going to die, right? They're going to die out. And we have to recognize that the country looks more diverse than the audiences that are at shows. So those particular spaces are dealing with a lot of economics. They're talking about like operating budgets in the millions of dollars. So there's a lot on the line for them to make sure they have a show that can sell to that audience base that they know of. So I have still, as a Asian American woman doing a solo show that's touring, I have still needed a certain kind of permission in my life. Like I definitely wasn't like, okay, I'm just going to go to Portland and do this show. Boom Arts, who was presenting my show here, had heard of my work, had taken it on, had agreed to put their money and their muscle behind it. So there are permissions in that sense. But I also, before I was getting funding and stuff like that, I was from a school of artists that would just put up stuff in living rooms, would put up stuff in small spaces in a room that was available, would get with someone. Someone would say, "Hey, I've got 10 minutes. Do you want to do something?" So that, you know, there's a certain kind of permission. But I have done in my process of working out shows, I've invited people to my living room, and I said, "Okay, I'm gonna feed you. You just have to sit there and watch and ask me any questions you're left with after the work." So it's a different set of permission. It's just like a lot more that's factored in these regional theaters that deal with like having to sell out shows every single day.
Do you think there's still a gender barrier in having women playwrights get their works produced by theaters?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's across gender, it's across race and class. To survive as a playwright or a theater maker is its own like amazing, insane feat, right? Like, there's theater. If theater is not, you know, what I would recommend to anybody who's looking to make a living wage, and but we, you know, you do it because you really enjoy it. You love the idea that you write something and actors take it on. Yeah, I mean, it's who's in that audience and who how they think they can relate to those stories. I even know I was in college in a Asian American theater company that was founded by Asian men, and even in that setting, as a woman, didn't feel that the women writers were really embraced and nurtured, and encouraged to write. And the attitude was sort of like, I remember having a conversation. This is like 20 years ago when I was in college. Everyone's like shocked to hear how old I am, and I'm still at this. Saying to another woman in the company, like, "God, I wish we had a play written by women." And then the male founder of the company was like, "Then write it." Like, it was just not like it's just like that's on you. It's your fault. And I don't think folks understand. I'm not saying that like, oh, we are inherently victims or whatever, but there's definitely a culture where women are not encouraged to pursue something like this the same way men might be encouraged. And I have seen in my profession when women choose to start families, and there's a lot of this invisible labor, a lot of time that they could be spending or should be, you know, could be spending writing their work is now in caring for their children or caring for the household, and not able to produce as much. And when you look at something like the grant writing cycle, at least in LA as I experience it, you need work as that you produce in the last 5 years. Now, if a woman has had a kid, and there are women who do both. There are many women who do both, but they will tell you it's not easy. The amount of work samples that you have available as a performing artist, if you've had a kid in the last 5 years, is going to be a lot less than someone who has not had a kid and has just been able to generate work. Like, I don't have children right now, and I don't know how I would do that on top of like running around the country trying to make a living. people tell me all the time I can do it. Mostly men say, you can do it. But I'm understanding my body and my schedule, and I know a lot would have to change if I took that on.
Even just talking about how you put this show together, mm-hmm. how you put the show together, you traveled. So you mm-hmm. traveled to Africa, you had all these experiences. So obviously that, you know, in itself is something that you were able to have because you had the freedom to do it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, I was at the time I went to Uganda, Northern Uganda, to research. So I was 35 years old. Like, and I was very much in a moment in my life where I had toured a show about depression and suicide called Wong Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. This is a different show that I won't be bringing to Portland this time around. But it was a pretty intense show. And I witnessed in the 8 years while I was touring that show, like, everything about the world shifted, as it does, that the theater didn't have that immediate response that YouTube suddenly had to respond to the world, or Twitter had to respond to the world. I witnessed a lot of my friends start their own families and stop coming to my shows because they had to take care of their kids, or they couldn't get childcare, or, you know, they just off to something else. They weren't young and 20 anymore. And I just wasn't sure why. I was just like, why am I making work anymore? What's the point of theater? You know, when in theory you can have so many more people see a tweet or a video, but that you can't really hit that same level of nuance in a viral video or a tweet, for sure, right? And I was just like, I just want to do something I've never done before. And that's go to Northern Uganda. And I never had that Peace Corps experience after college. Like, right after college, I worked for a nonprofit arts organization and was pursuing my artistic career. And I'm sort of guilty of having an eat, pray, love moment, right? Like an existential crisis, eat, pray, love moment. And raised all this money to go to Uganda. It was about $4,500. And worked for a microloan organization. And, I wasn't enlightened. There was no magic brown person who told me something about how to live my life. I just had to confront with every single interaction how much privilege and oppression I was complicit in just by being an American. And I know that that might be difficult for some people to understand, but other people who have traveled abroad, you really... The colonialism is much more pronounced, and what you look like to other people. For me, I was a Muzungu over there. I'm a white person over there. The first day I was there, the organization, and I really think it's because they you know, they're busy trying to run their organization and they don't really know what else to have me do in 3 weeks that I wouldn't screw up. They have me judge their Women for Peace Award. This is like, I just arrived and I'm supposed to pick who is the woman most worthy of this award, which means, you know, this award given to them for working so hard for peace in Northern Uganda. I just got there. I literally am off the boat. But as a Muzungu, you know, that's like this honorable thing. I'm now this ambassador when I'm really just a crazy playwright in America, you know? So, I mean, here's another situation, white privilege. As a Chinese American over there, as I made a hit rap album. I literally was walking along the street, saw these boys, was invited to go to this dark room behind them, and naively thought they were the gay community of Gulu because two of the men were holding hands. So all the codes are switched in my head, and I'm like, oh, they're organizing in the street. So I followed all these strange men into this dark room, and it turns out to be a music studio, and that night I started recording a rap album with them. And I don't think I could have done that if I had a child on my arm. Maybe I could have, but it definitely would have made things really different and a lot more expensive.
How much did you know about where you were going in Uganda before you decided on this organization?
Yeah. Well, I knew very little. I knew that there was a civil war there. I knew that there had been a warlord there. I am glad that I didn't watch. The major piece of media that was going around was a viral video called Kony 2012. And that was about Joseph Kony, who was the warlord who wanted to create a government based on the Ten Commandments. And he basically kidnapped children and to turn them into soldiers, and kidnapped girls who were both taken in as wives. And by wives, it means they were, you know, raped, and some of them were forced to become soldiers for the army. And I'm glad I didn't watch that video, because it would have, you know, given me a very one lens view into that country. So I had seen the Book of Mormon, which is the musical that the South Park guys wrote, and everything I'd seen was like in this very brutal context. Like I'd seen a play called Cooking Oil, which is how I ended up in Uganda, and everything was just sort of like very heavily tinged with like making me think I was stepping into like the most horrific situation on earth. And when I got there, it was like, oh, like people are functioning. Like this is, it doesn't look like this footage of like BBC footage of a refugee camp where, you know, kids are covered in flies and like following the reporter with like this empty look in their eyes. Like that's like the footage that I'd seen my entire life as an American.
Just this is what is going on in the other parts of the world, but you're only seeing the war.
Yeah. Yeah, and not people who are functional or people who will start their own organizations to change their lives. And the narrative very much becomes we as Americans, or we as civilized Westerners, have to go over there and help them. We have to send them money. We have to give them our old dirty clothes. We have to – and it completely strips people of dignity, and it completely erases this idea that people are actually capable of self-determining their own lives. And that became very clear when I got there. Like, I just remember every moment was so shocking to me. And I feel so silly now when I think about, like, well, of course people have jobs and can function and raise families and laugh and tell jokes. And but, you know, the image is so harsh and stark, and it's created this dangerous single narrative. I remember just being checked into a Hilton in the capital city. I'm like, oh, my God. There's a Hilton? A Hilton in Africa? Of course there's a Hilton in Africa. Like, it's a major city. And I'm just, like, looking at the woman who's checking me in. And I'm just, like, in my mind, I had thought that the Civil War took over the entire country when it was actually isolated above the Nile River in that country, which is why it was able to grow so crazy, is because, you know, you have to cross over the river and to this more rural area. But it's also... the British colonized Uganda, and they had determined that government type stuff would happen in the south, where the capital would be, and all the farming would happen in the north. And so there's existing kind of squabbles between tribes that became full on tension, which blew out into the Civil War. So it's not that like people were inherently uncivilized. It's like, guess what? The West keeps creating borders in places which blow out these tensions, and now we have these civil wars, and then suddenly we're like, okay, well, no, we'll fix it. When it's like we made that happen. So yeah, I mean, so a lot of the show, and I want to stress it, is a comedy. Pamela is a very serious interviewer. I wish folks at home could see how serious she is. She brings my seriousness out. I'm teasing. But I don't know, as a comedian, like when I was going through, I'm like, I don't know how to tell jokes about this. Like, I was so floored every moment. And I think I was like, I think I'm the buffoon. I think I'm the butt of this joke. I don't think the butt of the joke is the circumstances in which people live or how they live their lives. There are some jokes about, they're just like different Africanisms in there, which I think are lighthearted. But I think ultimately the butt of the joke is me, is sort of presenting myself as the archetype of the do-good American and the do-good activist who usually sits at home on an armchair and fights everybody from an iPad and throws out hashtags to fight this revolution. But then once faced in like the belly of a real situation. It's like, I don't have the Wi-Fi. The man that's in the room that created this big mess is me. I'm the one who's benefited the most from colonialism, from oppression. And now I'm in the room thinking I'm trying to fix it, but really I don't know anything. I made a rap album, right? Like, believe it or not, nobody here in America has scouted me in my old age to create a rap album. And that is the benefit. You think these rappers in Uganda really thought I had what it take to? No, they saw at the end of the day, here's somebody who has access to the rest of the world and who could possibly help. And I have. I've helped them get their music to America. I've helped them have a presence in America because I tell this story about meeting them. I love those guys because they sort of fulfilled, like, you know, you're like here a rock and roll fantasy camp. It was like Northern Uganda hip hop fantasy camp. Like, that's what I was going through.
I just love that there were these feminist rap lyrics that you brought into it.
I didn't even have to try that hard. Like, mm-hmm. I've always in past works been very critical of like what I find, like what I would then term as like activist art or like mm-hmm. angry poetry. And I tell the story in the show when after I gave out the award to these women in the most awkward way possible, because that's who I am, complete butthead, right? And as I hand out this big award, someone in America messages me on Facebook and is like, can you help me? I have old clothes. Can you help me get it over there to help some people in need? And I'm like, I just gave awards out to well-dressed women who, yes, were kidnapped by Joseph Kony's army, but are also now organizing on behalf of these women to fight against gender-based violence, right? And you want me to drag your old dirty clothes from Orange County, California, halfway around to Gulu to like throw at these award winners? Are you serious? Like, this is how you really think? But this is, you know, that's a very naive thing that Americans think, like, oh, I have old clothes. You want to bring them over there? Like, that is such a stupid use of my time. And it's such an insult to all the women that I've met who are much, you know, who are much better than your stupid, dirty clothes. And then I found myself so angry. It was like going through my freshman year of college all over again. And because there was no internet, no one to war with, I was just writing these lyrics. And I couldn't believe there's a song I wrote called Boss Lady. Your voice of time has come to drop down to your knees, dethrone yourselves and crown the matriarchy. No more reigning your terror. A new queen has come. Castrating sexism will be the first order done. Like, I would, if you told me I was going to write something like that, you know, 5 years ago, I'd be like, shut up. I'm way too ironic. I'm way too meta. I was writing such like insane, angry like lyrics. And even Nerio, the music producer, the Ugandan music producer, is like, I think we need to take it down a little. And
really?
Let's make this next song techno, please. So the next song is like this techno song I make. But, you know, it's so...
Nerio's stuff was like danceable.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're not even as angry as I am. Like, but I just was going through this internal struggle of like being angry at other Americans, but seeing that naiveness that they expressed in myself. And which is sort of the self-loathing activist stuff coming out, where it's like, of course it's easy to say we're going to fight for revolution, we're going to do that. We all know if those of us who've actually been to the trenches or sat through a meeting of revolutionaries, how exhausting it is, and and how sometimes it feels fruitless and depressing and endless, and if people aren't fighting us, we're fighting each other, you know. And I'm not saying that this is how it is in all communities, but it is hard. This is very hard work to actually figure out how do you shift the world. I mean, I went to Uganda for 3 weeks thinking I am going to do the work of shifting the world, and I left going, oh God, I don't know. I do feel like my contributions towards shifting the world, while I did not save, this is the thing, is nobody needs to be saved. We are constantly, America needs to save ourselves. You sat and watched that debate. But America does not need to save Africa, right? We need to understand that. I think we have to come to a very strong like sit down and realize that people are capable of saving themselves. It's just we were born on this end of capitalism, so we have all the money. So if there is an intelligent way, a thoughtful way to invest in people being able to self-determine their lives, to find the organizations that people are creating on the ground there, that local people in those parts of the world are creating to help the communities they know. And there are some that are scammy, which is unfortunate. But finding the there are wonderful, reputable ones. How do we work in alignment with them? How do we stand in support of them? It's like that's what allyship is. How do we get out of their way, right? And not tell them how to be civilized or how to work, but how do we understand what it is that we have and to support them with it, not in like a giveaway pity way, but in a working towards cooperation and not charity.
Hashtag not your stereotype, and then I send that hashtag out on the social media. Hashtag stop. Ban white male privilege. Hashtag stop priority boarding status privilege. So many words in the English language. It's like the possibilities are endless. Hashtag no. Hashtag cancel. Hashtag boo. Hashtag don't. Hashtag boo. And then people who begin to notice my hashtags and you throw them back at me. Go ahead, throw them at me. See, that's a retweet. The legacy that I leave when I die? Hashtags? Twitter followers? YouTube views? There has to be more to life than this. Christina, you cannot have an existential crisis right now. Existential crises are for those women who read, eat, pray, love. Stronger than those privileged, disillusioned white women. But I feel like I spend so much time in this armchair, it's like I have no idea what world it is I'm critiquing anymore. Christina, if you actually leave this armchair and engage the world instead of calling people out for how they engage the world, someone is bound to call you out. But I miss nuance. I miss really exploring the depth of a situation instead of just shouting shocking things from this armchair, hoping that people will look in my direction. I just want to go somewhere and engage it and leave a legacy. Oh, yeah? Where would you go? I'll go to the default symbol for all the world's pain and suffering. I'll go to hashtag Africa.
You're tuning in, you're listening to KBOO's Bread and Roses. This is Pamela Santos. I'm with Christina Wong from the upcoming show, The Wong Street Journal.
Can we talk about where it plays?
Yes, please.
The Wong Street Journal is going to be at the Headwaters on 55 Northeast Farragut Street. It's being presented October 13th through 15th and October 20th through 23rd. So you've got 7 opportunities to see it, and then I leave town forever. You, by the time you listen to this, it will have happened, but I will be at the public library on Monday night, and I'm in conversation with a lot of different community groups after the show.
And the thing about the community groups, that's just to what I see it as. I see it as a way to break down the barriers of what is the supposed traditional theater goer.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I definitely make theater. I realize it's okay to admit I fall asleep during Shakespeare shows. I don't think there's one Shakespeare production that I haven't been bored just a little. I think about my parents who did not take me to theater when I was growing up. Like, I found theater in high school and was like, wow, I can be something other than this, like, Chinese robot that just gets good grades and is supposed to become a doctor and marry an engineer or a doctor and have doctor babies and become Miss Chinatown. Like, I think...
To become Miss Chinatown of San Francisco, though.
That's a big deal. But that's another performance piece I've done. I used to walk around as a character called Fanny Wong, former Miss Chinatown, second runner up. And I used to like have a cigar in my mouth. And I would just basically show up with a Miss Chinatown sash, wearing glasses and sneakers. And I would just sort of dry hump people in the street and sign autographs and just walk alongside the actual Miss Chinatown court. Because it was just like, I'm awesome. Why do I have to be in a freaking pageant to be the most awesome of the awesome? Like, it sort of confront, like, what are we, what kind of standards are we putting Chinese women up to? The same, like, why is beauty a contest or perfection a contest? Like, can we drive each other more crazy than I already am day to day with my mother?
You're able to really put these, I see it in when you were very, very sweetly, I think I'm going to say it as going after Jeremy Lin during the height of Lin Sanity.
People say stalking. I think that's a negative word. I know. I was very publicly.
Lovingly.
Letting him know that I was going to marry him.
And have his Chinese babies.
Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. And I think, you know, while, you know, we may never have met, but it's not going to stop me from consummating our relationship. You know, I started a Kickstarter to raise money when he was playing for the Lakers to get 2 courtside tickets to see him, with the idea that he would see me, he would fall in love with me, and propose to me on the spot. But except it costs $5,400 for 2 courtside Lakers tickets. It takes money to marry money. So I fell about $300 short and didn't get any money to buy those tickets.
That's it? That's all you...
was $300 short.
Well, I say only, by the way.
So I do think that if we're going to talk about Jeremy Lin, he has pet names for me, and he uses them in interviews and tweets.
No.
Yeah. God, him, with a capital H, our Lord. That's him talking to me. He does it for our Lord. That's me. That is love talk.
Now you have to get to Brooklyn.
I know.
How are you gonna?
I guess on an airplane. I heard they make those.
Well, the thing is, I think Brooklyn Nets tickets are cheaper. Gotta say.
Yeah. I didn't. I was like, the Nets are in, what?
I know.
Yeah. This is how I follow basketball. I'm like, he's the point guard. What does he do, you guys? A bunch of Asians now watch basketball thanks to Jeremy Lin. And we're learning how it works.
It's awesome that way. It's there's actually websites, you know, more following sports now. And you're like, yeah, Jeremy Lin's up there, right there. But I even brought up that because I think the thing that I like about the Wong Street Journal is, and of course, this is my view. I mean, it's up for debate. It's good for people to go and see it, to see what they think about it. But in a lot of ways, with some of your previous work, where I feel like there are some characters in your public performance work, but then there's also these very personal things that you've done in your theater shows. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is just another, like, very personal kind of side of you that you're putting in this show? Like,
I think it's super personal. This to me, I think about it a lot. It's very hard in the kind of activist online culture that I'm witnessing from my corner of the internet to admit that you're wrong. What I'm experiencing when I'm on Twitter and watching hashtag campaigns take off is a culture of shaming, right? Like, and it's not just like the left versus the right. I'm watching activists shame other activists. And young activists shame older activists, and there's not a lot of space for conversation, dialogue, and getting things wrong. I'm trying to think whether or not it's worth it to go into an example of what I'm talking about. Nope.
But
I don't feel like you have to really, really, at the end of the day, keep in mind that this is not about ego, but a movement. But sometimes when I'm watching activists go after each other, or people who just care go after each other, and I'm guilty too. I go after people all the time. With step back, go, is this about my ego? Or is this about a greater movement, right? And in this show, I think I am very good about admitting that I don't know everything. I'm an activist. I set myself up as a character that thinks she knows everything, that is the star of the internet, that can take people down in a hashtag war, that can go viral. But when it comes down to it, there are things I don't know. And that was the hardest thing to write into the show, was I was afraid when I came back from Uganda, I was like, I am afraid that I will write a show and I will be the target of an internet war, that I will be like, people will go, oh, Christina thinks she's a white savior. Oh, Christina thinks that she has the voice to tell Africa's story, which I do not, by the way. I have the voice to tell my own story, right? And I got really scared because I see the way people get taken down online and delete their accounts because they're chased off Twitter or whatever.
It's a very specific
world I'm referencing.
It's
right?
specific, but it's the attack on women on Twitter is so. It's you can't ignore that it's gendered.
Yeah, it's completely gendered, and people get real personal. And I've done interviews. Like I was interviewed by a shock jock, and his crazy listeners after were like, "Well, she's ugly anyway." I'm like, "What? Why did that do anything?" And you're ugly too. But like, I didn't know I was in a beauty pageant. I thought I was just talking about my work. And you're wrong. Not. But
yeah, you have the rocking lashes right now.
Rocking lashes. Great butt. But that was what was. That's what's really vulnerable, and that's what I can do in my theater shows that I can't do in these essays that I'm trying to make go viral. Or I've written about depression in essays that have gone viral, but it's a really tricky art, right? We live in a no attention. I mean, Donald Trump is evidence of a culture that reads the headline and gets excited, or can only hear a string of adjectives with nothing to back it up over and over again, and somehow he's elected. He uses the word terrific. It's gonna be really great.
Everything is superlatives, right?
Yeah, and it's like he cannot back up how he's doing that. But I think it's easier to hear those adjectives than to hear actual detail, because it's a lot of work to actually get through the detail of how something is done. And he's using like very basic vocabulary, right? And I think his success is indicative of this clickbait culture that we live in. So I think this is where people should be returning to theater. Like, why are we going to be in a space with live bodies where we turn our phones off for 2 hours or an hour? It's because there's a certain vulnerability, a human vulnerability, right? That things could go wrong in this space, that I am sharing the same air. I can watch a trail of spit come off. It's not edited. I can even maybe talk to the artist afterward. And I can sit inside this very human moment that we don't have access to anymore. And I mean, I don't know about you. After the debate, watching the debate, I was just like so traumatized. Like, is this is what American democracy has become? Just like a weird reality show where we parade out women that have allegedly been raped in the 90s by Bill Clinton, and to somehow top or take your attention away from the fact that a presidential candidate thinks that locker room talk is just words and acceptable behavior for a future president.
And he doesn't believe in marital rape.
Yeah, he doesn't believe in marital rape. That it's not possible for a husband to rape their wife. Like, what feudal era are you from that you believe that this is a thing?
So that was already struck down in 1984 in New York. I looked it up.
Yeah, husbands can rape wives. Like, this is a thing. So
bringing it back to your show.
Back.
So the thing about,
I'm getting all so upset. I'm trying to push the show. No, please, I swear to you, the show's funny.
So the thing about the comedy is that I think what you're saying about being in this very, what to me theater is you are in this momentary space. It's ephemeral. You don't do as much as you try. Like, it's not the same show every show. And that's the nature of theater. It's that's the beauty of it. That's what I actually love about it. It only lasts in this moment.
Yeah. I mean, I can do the script over and over again, but even in the last year and a half since I've been touring the show, I'm hearing the lines differently. My perspective on how I feel about it is different. We're still making some small changes in the script as I'm learning more and more as it goes. And I feel like as the months go on, as I live with this and as my relationship continues with people in Uganda that I met who are, you know, talked about in the show, I feel like my insights change and the way I approach the show changes. But it also has a different relationship with the world around the theater, right? Black Lives Matter was not really a thing when I came back from Uganda. And I had many moments where I was understanding Black Lives Matter is not just an American movement, but it's something I don't think, when you think about like these things, these atrocities that happen in Africa, and we don't panic the way we panic when something happens in France, right? That's an example of like, why are Black Lives not mattering in that situation? Because maybe we're used to thinking of, oh, that's where tragedy happens. That's where death happens. It's a normal thing. But France, oh, no.
I only heard about the atrocities against Black people in Brazil, in Rio, when the Olympics.
I didn't hear about that.
No. Yeah, there's a big movement also against state-sanctioned police brutality against Black Brazilians in Rio.
That all got, you know, I missed it.
So it's totally out there.
And as I try to understand as an Asian American, as a cis woman, like, what is my relationship to the Black Lives Matter movement in America? As somebody who can walk freely in the street, and in fact, like, I would say even in my Asian body, if I can kind of, like, a cop would probably suspect me less than a white woman, because maybe they're used to my face being code for, oh, she's this quiet little Asian woman not doing anything, you know. Not saying that this is there are many situations where I've been in a room and nobody takes me seriously when I speak up because they're not used to somebody in my body speaking up, right? So I'm not saying, oh yeah, I'm so privileged with this body, but so how do I stand up for Black folks who are targets of violence or targets of being suspect by the police, you know? And I think about that as we have this encampment in LA right now by City Hall, and like, how do I literally stand in that space, in that area? How do I literally, like, is it okay for me to take some snacks from the snack table if I haven't been here this whole time? And like, you know, like I like every, it's not just like, I'm with them, but like, you know, I really think about these interactions and how to be most helpful. And there's a lot of parallel to the connection I've had with my friends in Uganda and with my Black friends here who are working with BLM movement.
It's really hard to explain how the comedy makes that all palatable until you see it. Like, it's really hard to explain that, but it's there, and that's how you navigate, and you're not kind of throwing this at the audience. And definitely it's more of, I was thinking about that too, where I think whatever people come in the theater with, and that's, I guess, as an audience member, they're coming in now with what we're seeing in the media, what, you know, Black Lives Matter is right now, different people of color here in Portland especially. So the thing that I especially liked about your show is that you got to talk about privilege and oppression in a way where Asian Americans were usually used as wedges to further oppress Black people.
Mm-hmm. We're either used as examples of like, look, pull yourself up by your bootstraps like those Asians, or I mean, some things that have been thrown at me are like, well, China is the next big superpower, so you have actually have Chinese privilege, and you're not oppressed because China's going to own us all. And like, I'm like, whoa, I don't get the checks. And then, but yeah, I think it's definitely because like in this weird way, it's like we are next in line for white privilege, but we were never going to fully have that privilege, but we also experience marginalization. So I definitely am sitting with that a lot post this trip and play a lot with that inside the Wong Street Journal. It's just like I sometimes am white to folks and I'm Chinese to folks, and this, the people of color solidarity that is talked about in activist circles in America does not exist at all in Uganda. Like they don't go, oh, but she's an Asian American. So that means she experiences being perpetually foreign, and we can relate to that as Ugandan people. Like that never happened. I was a Mzungu, right? And I felt like a Mzungu. I felt like a big, clumsy white person walking through, like not knowing what was going on. It was such a world different than what I know, right? So a lot of that is dealt with in very fun ways.
And there is a lot of fun. There's a lot of laughs. There really are. And it's a way that I think people need. It's almost cathartic.
Yeah. I mean, for me, what means a lot to me is my parents, who don't go a lot of stuff. I haven't gotten their opinion on Black Lives Matter. I'm a little afraid to hear what it is because I don't. You know, I just can't deal with like, people close to me misunderstanding it and going, well, why don't they not be so militant? Or like whatever, you know, BS things that people say about that movement. But I think what it's, I want them to be able to relate to at least the naiveness in which we read another culture, right? And the naiveness and in which we think that our intentions are the best intentions. And that's what I am trying to speak to those audience members, the ones that look at Africa or, oh, you're going to Africa? Oh, you're so brave, right? Like, let's confront that basic narrative or the basic emotional reaction to this idea of somebody goes to Africa. Oh, wow. You know?
And Portland is a really great city, I think,
for this show.
Well, this particular show to be here, because I think considering the reputation it has as America's whitest city or like biggest metropolitan area, that erases a lot of just like the existence of people of color and especially like African Americans here who've been in Oregon, who've been in Portland especially. So I think a lot of what you cover, and again, in a really palatable like way with like the funny takes and everything, is the only way I feel like race or privilege or oppression get to be talked about in a lot. There's comedy shows here. There's other things here that if we didn't have comedy, even for Black Portlanders and even for other people of color here, you can't deal with the day to day in a way if you didn't have a way to laugh, a way to get something out.
I was very clear that when I came back that yelling at an audience for 85 minutes, you're privileged, you know it, that's the wrong approach. It's exhausting for me, it's exhausting for them, but I think to own up, I think, you know, because of the way messages have to pierce and go viral, this is what brings that human element back of like, yeah, sometimes I'm wrong. Sometimes I'm wrong as an activist. Sometimes I don't get it all right. And I think that's why the show's been so successful, is because it's not preachy and I don't have all the answers. And I think a lot of people really can relate to that. And if we're so afraid to make a mistake and go about our activism wrong or being called out for saying something wrong, that we either just don't participate or just join the witch hunt online and like, let me find someone else to call out. Which is actually what sort of Trump did yesterday. He's like, oh no, Colley, no, he's the rapist, you know, and that doesn't actually end rape culture. It doesn't actually address the suffering of the women. It just gives them more, you know, like, okay, no, attack this one, attack that one, attack this one. But why? Let's take a pause and go, you know, we all messed up. I'm not saying him. I don't know how Trump's going to address that crap. But at least in terms of where we don't get things right. Yeah.
And that's where I feel like your show, after touring how many months?
World premiered June last year. So it's been a little over a year. I haven't been touring consistently. It's like every few months I'll do a tour.
So it can still feel fresh.
No. Yeah, it still does. I mean, the world still goes. World's still racist. I was in Canada, actually. In Canada, I think, thanks to Michael Moore, has been passed off as like this multicultural fantasia of unlocked doors. I don't know if anyone's seen what documentary, Bowling for Columbine, right? And I was like, and I still live with that. I don't spend that much time in Canada. And I did an excerpt of the show to a bunch of Canadians, and I said, did the show translate over to you? And they're like, yes, we are also racist. It did. We are also very racist. And I was like, oh, you know?
Very racist with indigenous peoples, apparently.
So it's a long fight, you know? Yeah. I think, you know, ideally we can all get on the same page and just keep moving forward. But there are people who still think Muslim is a race, you know?
And
a lot of them are voting for Trump.
I'm still, yeah. There you go. So tell us one more time how people can watch your show.
The show is The Wong Street Journal. It is playing October 13th through 23rd. There are only 7 shows. It's a small 66-seat theater, say that 5 times fast, at the Headwaters on 55 Northeast Farragut Street. And you can buy tickets at boomarts.org. Boomarts.org.
So you get your tickets online, everyone.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about the talkbacks that are going to happen. On which days, again, are the talkbacks? It's going to be the first one. So we're airing tonight, Friday. So after your show,
we're going to do a talkback on the opening night on 13th with the director, Emily Mendelsohn, my amazing director, and Ruth, who is the artistic director of Boom Art. She's so fabulous. And then on Friday the 14th at 7:30, we're doing one with a lot of POC, Candace Keita from Cultural Work and Development. Candace Keita's job is the Cultural Work and Development Coordinator at APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. That they're located in an old furniture store. DeMay Roberts, who is the writer, producer, media artist, executive producer, media rights, and theater diaspora. She's really great. And we're doing a talk back every single night, just with different people, it almost looks like.
It's great. There's actually a lot of KBOO people.
A lot of talk.
So you have DeMay, who also has a show, Stage and Studio here. But also
Saturday,
on the 20th, is Susan Addy, Obo Addy, Legacy Project, and our own Mike Crenshaw from the Africa Hip Hop Caravan. And I see Tracy Cameron Francis, Cascade Festival of African Films, and one more time, Mike Crenshaw on the 21st. And this is also my name.
Yeah, and if we don't do a called talk back, there's one out on the 22nd, there's one on 23rd, yeah. I think there's a talkback every night. It's just which Portland All-Stars do you want to see at the talkback? And if there isn't a talkback, we can just make a talkback happen. You just ask me a question. I'm pretty accessible.
I feel like people have questions afterwards.
They do. They absolutely do.
They do. That's good. So anywhere else that people can find your other work, online or otherwise?
My name starts with a K. ChristinaWong.com, and you can find me at Ms. Christina Wong on Twitter. I love live tweeting about these debates and the election. So there's lots of gems that need retweets.
And videos, too.
Yeah, on Christina Wong on YouTube.
So thank you so much, Christina.
Thank you, Pamela. See you at Boom Arts.
You've been listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland. Thank you so much for listening. Many thanks to our engineer and our evening public affairs director, Lisa Loving. And we're going to Tune out to the sounds of more from Christina Wong's rap album. Have a good night, everybody.
Boss lady.
I'm a lady, not a bitch, not a trick, not a hoe. Hit a woman, call her names, misogyny has gotta go. Rise up, speak up, stand up for your mothers. Walk aside and step back, that's how to be our brothers. She knows how to manage money, cause she knows what's missing. She can hold down a family despite all his dissing. Rock the baby on her back and feed the whole front. Keep humility in check when no one asks what she wants. Keeps walking head high when you catcall. Won't ever give in when everyone hits the wall. She doesn't clown your ass when you can't get it up, but she's willing to please when you can't get enough. Breastfeeding and cleaning, she's the silent force of life. She ain't your slave nor your property just because she's a wife. Holds it in when it matters, empathizes and strives. She feels the pain of a village and leaves it back to all right.
Yeah.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Space is the Place, showing Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. Space is the Place is an Afrofuturist science fiction classic film released in 1974. Sun Ra, space age prophet, philosopher and Afro-jazz bandleader, lands his spaceship in Oakland, expanding the cosmic consciousness of African Americans. Again, that's Space is the Place, Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of your homepage under Community Events. Thank you.
KBOO at the Clinton.